Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited. Subscribe to us through iTunes. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. You can also access our entire archive of content, including over 700 filmmaker interviews, at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net. To Movie Geeks United. A little bit later on in the show, we'll be talking to actor, writer, director, producer Larry Fessenden about his latest project, the second season of the great audio play series Tales from Beyond the Pale. Also, in a little bit, we'll be talking about all the great new movie releases, including Gravity, Captain Phillips, and many, many others. There's lots to talk about. But first, our headline interview for the evening is none other than Gunnar Hansen. We've been trying to get Mr. Hansen on the show for several years now, and we finally done it because he has a new book out titled Chainsaw Confidential that reflects on the 40th anniversary of the massive, infamous film that is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, in which he played a large part as the character of Leatherface. In this conversation, we speak to Mr. Hansen about the legacy of that film, his role in it, some behind-the-scenes tidbits, and also his feelings about horror movies and where those fall into the culture today. Enjoy.
The most bizarre and brutal series of crimes in America.
Tell me about your book, why this felt like the perfect time to relive those memories.
Well, I had thought about this book on and off for a long time, and I think my big problem, or the shortcoming of the book that I always saw, was that the book was too small. I never thought I really had enough to tell. And then I realized that what I needed to do was interview everyone involved with the movie. Because that way, first of all, the book would be much broader because I could talk about those things that I wasn't there for, but I would still have firsthand accounts of those. And the book would be deeper in that even for those things that I remember, I have other memories of it, other people's versions or takes on it. And I felt that would really improve the book and just make it more substantial. Plus, I decided I wanted to talk about more than just the shooting of the film, in talking about the aftermath, the public reception and the critical reception to the book, and what that meant about critics and the public, and ultimately how that perception evolved, and you know where Chainsaw fits in. But if I talked about those things too, then I would have a book that would actually be interesting to a broad audience. So it took thinking about that before I realized that's a book I could do. And then I think as members of the cast and crew died, I thought, if I'm going to do this book, I got to do it now. So that's why I did it.
You know, what always fascinates me are those occasions where you set out, you probably thought this was a little film. It was a little film. You probably had very little thought in your head that it would become a cultural phenomenon. When did you first realize it had become that phenomenon, and how did it feel to be a part of it? Did it kind of redefine the experience at all for you?
Well, it's funny because you're right. I really didn't know what to expect, and I thought about it when we were filming and immediately after, how do I measure this movie? What has to happen for it to be a success in my mind? And I really, the biggest dream I could imagine for this book, for this movie, would be that 5 years down the road, there'd be a few hardcore fans that remembered it. So, yes, it was a huge shock when I realized it was so big. And I really didn't realize what this movie was becoming for a long time, because I left Texas the year after Chainsaw came out and moved to New England, where I didn't even watch TV for many, many years. And it was really when I went out to L.A. in 1987 and was working on a movie out there, because I had been turning movies down. And I went out there and worked on a movie, and one of the actresses came up to me on the second day of shooting and said, "Gee, you're actually a nice guy." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, you know, your role is so famous and the movie's so big, I just figured you'd be a jerk." And that's when I realized that the movie was big and that no one on the set had talked to me the first day. And so that was really the beginning. And then soon after that, or a couple of years after that, I saw an episode of Cheers in which Rebecca, the Kirstie Alley character, is out on a big house by herself. And the last line of the show is, "Oh, Leatherface, I hope that's not you." And I think that was the clincher, because I realized that the movie and the character had become so much part of the culture that she didn't have to explain to anybody who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And that really was when I saw how big it had become and how it really entered the culture. As far as its effect on me, I don't think it changed my perspective on the movie, because I'd always been very aware of how miserably difficult it was. And also, I had always been very pleased with what we'd ended up with, because just watching the movie the first time I saw it back in 1974, it seemed so much better than I could have dreamed that it would be. I mean, I still didn't imagine it would be huge, but I liked the movie. So my perception of the movie and the experience really never changed when I realized that it had become so big. I think what changed was my shock, I guess I have to put it. I mean, I think it was a very, I don't even know how to say this. I was thrilled that the movie had been that big, became that big. Yeah. And I was delighted that I was lucky enough to be part of it.
Yeah, I mean, more than just the success of being seen so much over the years, it's become a cultural landmark. I mean, it's in the Museum of Modern Art. Leatherface is common vernacular. And what interests me is why you think it hit the zeitgeist, because we're used to now so many films that followed Chainsaw being so owing a lot to the influence of that film. But what was groundbreaking about it in 1974 when it came out?
Well, I think, there had been a couple of movies that were groundbreaking not very long before it. And what was it, 1961, there was Psycho. And Psycho really broke some rules. The main character died halfway through the movie. And the main character wasn't heroic. I mean, she was stealing money, And then there was Night of the Living Dead, which also had a very dark vision and I think was groundbreaking. So, there were a couple of movies before, but certainly Chainsaw was one of those movies that just changed some of the rules. I think in Chainsaw's case, first of all, the movie was so realistic, and I think that was very new with horror movies. It was not an expressionist Murnau movie, This you felt like you were watching, and I think that was, that you were in on it, and I think that was a very new thing. It treated death very casually, which I think was new in the sense that the camera never lingers on the image. You know, the camera just moves along like it's in real time, as if the camera and therefore the eye of the audience is indifferent to death. It just happens. And I think the third element that was really radical was that it was such a nihilistic film. There is no justice at the end of this movie. Although the hitchhiker is killed, the rest of the family get away, and the only survivor is Sally, who is so badly damaged emotionally, it's hard to believe she will ever be normal.
And there's also this, I mean, you do get a feeling of the dynamic between the family members and between the kids, but it's largely devoid of backstory or motivation. But you know, you as an actor, when preparing Leatherface, I mean, those are the kinds of things that you have to concern yourself with to create that character. How did your perception of Leatherface and his world come about?
Well, I was lucky in that, Toby and Kim, the director and the writer, you know, we met when they were deciding whether to cast me, and they told me a lot about the character's personality and his relationship to the family. So they gave me basically my research. They told me what I needed to know about the character. Then I, of course, had to figure out how I was going to present all that. So even though we don't know their backstory, other than the fact that they're unemployed slaughterhouse workers, we get in the audience, we get a very clear picture of the dynamic within the family and the dynamic among the victims. So my job was to figure out how to present that character. And the limitations I had were I had neither face nor voice, so I really had to rely entirely on my body. So the way I prepared for that was I went to a residential school for retarded persons and spent a couple of days walking around, watching the way people moved. I'd spent time there before because my mother worked at a clinic there. And so I'd been on the campus, you know, now and then. And so I just walked around. It was open campus. People, you know, residents were walking around there. And I just watched the way people moved. And I tried to find some posture or postures and some movements that I felt would work for me and find them in these other people. The problem was finding them in a way that made sense. You know, you can sort of acquire a bunch of tics, but if they don't work as a whole, they don't mean much of anything. So that's what I did. I spent a couple of days out there. And then finally, on the second day, one of the staff, there was a couple of staff people walking down the sidewalk, and I sort of slipped into this Leatherface mode to see what would happen, and they walked right past me and looked right through me as if I were just, you know, another resident there. So I felt at that point that maybe I had the character the way I wanted.
Yeah. You know, there's something else that that John Landis says in your book that I think was terrific. He said, you know, you maybe empathize is too strong of a word. It's not so much that you empathize with Leatherface as so much as, you know, you recognize that this isn't one of those serial killers that kill young people with glee. I mean, he's genuinely worried by what he has to do and wondering what the heck is going on when all of these kids start to show up at his house.
Yeah, and I think that what's interesting is, you know, Leatherface, although he's unknowable, you know, and I think that's part of why he's so frightening, he's clearly not merely evil. You know, he's more than just evil. He has some sort of complexity in that he is torn and frightened about doing this, but feels that this is what he must do. And I think this is part of why the movie is compelling, is that the audience is drawn into a certain ambiguity, which is normally you sympathize with the victims. But in this film, you're also invited to sympathize with the family. Because you can turn around the normal sort of sense of protagonist-antagonist and say it's the family that's put upon by the kids. You know, it's the kids who come in and invade the home of the family. And that ambiguity, I think, is part of why people continue to look at this movie now.
How do you think the movie is of its time, a reflection of the time in which it was made?
Boy, that's a hard one because I'm of that time too. I mean, there is the obvious context of you know, gas shortage and all of that, but that I think is just trivial. I think the main thing is, this country went through a change. We've long since, you know, there was a time when the wilderness was considered very frightening. I mean, I think Henry Thoreau in the 1800s is really among the first to say, you know, in wilderness is the preservation of the world. And so we always have tended to look at civilized life as safe and that going out into the wilderness as extremely dangerous. And as time has passed, our notion of that has become, we who live in the city are terribly afraid of country folk because they are the horrible, you know, masses. And country folk are dangerous to us. And I think that's what you see in this movie. This movie really represents that kind of fear, which really started to end in the 70s and, you know, and in the late 70s when we started saying, you know, country life is wonderful and urban life is the evil. But, you know, this movie really sees it the other way, which I think is because it was made at the time when that point of view was changing but hadn't changed yet. And I think that ties it very much to the 70s.
Also, you're in the midst and in the wake of Vietnam. Did that give a different resonance to a movie where young people are being slaughtered?
Well, you know, I think there are those who feel that this movie is about Vietnam, and I never really thought of it that way, but I mean, for myself, but sure, I think that could certainly make sense, and it makes sense also in the larger context that, you know, I said this is a very nihilistic movie, and I think by this point, there are a lot of people saying that something like the war was meaningless, you know, just like there is no order in this film, you know, that... Mm. That these people died in the war, and they died in this war for nothing. They died in that war because the United States thought there were large oil fields in offshore in Vietnam. You know, they talked communism and all that baloney, but that's what was going on. And so I think there is that sense that, you know, a lot of people are dying for no reason. And here we go with a horror movie in which a lot of people die for seemingly no reason at all. And with no justice for them, which is, I think, also the kind of perception. I think America was very disillusioned by the Vietnam War. Certainly by this point, you know, the turnaround started in about 1970 or 71, when finally most of the people in America started saying, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. And certainly you can look at this movie as in some ways representing that disillusionment and that dark awareness of the world.
Well, I think that horror movies are so ideally suited for kind of subversive socio-political commentary. Even if that's not their aim, by their very nature, they tend to reflect that. But when you look at the horror film climate of today, do you think that genre still has that investment in the world in which we live, or have we lost that?
Well, I don't think it's so strong anymore because we go through these cycles, and one of the things that happens, I think, is that right now we're in a period of high popularity for horror movies, which means big financial investments by mainstream studios and producers. And that's very cyclical. And the problem is, as films become mainstream, as horror films become mainstream, they no longer have much to say. And I think that's, you know, the big sorrow of it is, finally, people are willing to put money into horror movies, and it's at that point where horror movies stop saying much of anything. And that's why I'm convinced that the next Toby Hooper is going to be some kid who raises a few thousand dollars and makes a movie with his friends. Because I don't know that you can change the horror genre or develop it or let it evolve or say anything really powerful when you're so deeply embedded in the status quo.
Yeah, I agree with you. just the most terrifying scene I've ever experienced in a film is your first appearance. And you speak about it in great detail in your book. Can you just give me a morsel of what it was like to shoot that particular scene where you kill Kirk?
Well, you know, it was funny because that's really my first time on camera. It was my first scene to shoot. So I was so charged up on adrenaline and so excited and keyed up to do it that I was really hopping back and forth, you know, off camera there. I was just really moving and edgy, and I just was, you know, I was in flight or fight mode, I guess. And so I think part of the reason the scene works so well is because I'm moving very quickly. Some people ask me if that scene's been sped up, which it has not. And I'm just moving so quickly, and I'm so charged up that, you know, I picked him up. I was supposed to just pick up Kirk, just lift him and drag him out of the shot. But actually what I did was I picked him up and threw him out of the shot, and he actually threw him headfirst into a wall. And I think that, you know, that shows, that energy shows in that scene. And then, of course, I slammed the door. The door weighed nothing. I mean, you know, it was this piece of sheet metal with a very light wooden framework behind it. But because the way it was constructed, it jammed when I slammed it up against the wall. And so it looked like it must have weighed half a ton because it didn't bounce at all. Mm-hmm. And then I think the final element that really makes that such a frightening scene is there's a stinger in the soundtrack right there. There's this very deep tone, which is in the same pitch. I think it's like an octave down from the tone you get from the slamming door. And that carries right into the next scene when Pam is out on the swing, and that I think makes it more menacing because you've now carried that menace of the slamming door right out to Pam, who's sitting out in the sunshine.
Yeah, and of course being followed by that fantastic tracking shot that's been so revered for many years. We've spoken to Daniel Pearl several times on the show. He's a favorite guest of ours, and you know, the movie is so overwhelmingly powerful when you first see it that it took me many years to actually recognize the great artistic value of it in elements like the photography and the direction and the story structure. The last question I want to ask you is about meeting the fans, because the 40th anniversary is around the corner. I'm sure that you're going to be attending conventions and such to with your book and to celebrate the legacy of this film. I'm seeing you in Orlando later this month. Tell me, what does that mean to you? Is that a satisfying experience to you to interact with fans?
It really is. It's a great experience. You know, horror fans are so respectful. You know, they're so devoted to the movies and respectful of the people who work in the movies, you know, in these horror movies, that it's always a pleasure to meet them. And they're also very thoughtful about the movie. I get a lot, of course, the same questions because they don't know I've been asked the question before. But almost invariably, someone will ask me a question that I had not only had not thought of, but really makes me think about the movie in a new way. So I really enjoy it. And of course, everybody likes to be told how wonderful they are. So I really enjoy going to these conventions. In fact, I have to be careful not to go to too many because I start believing it. But yeah, I think it's terrific.
Well, I can't wait to meet with you later this month. And your book is phenomenal, and we'll sell it hard on our website and during our show. And thank you so much for the role you've played in my love of movies. It's meant a lot to me, so thank you.
Well, thanks, Jamie. It was great.
Okay, that was Gunnar Hansen. The book is titled Chainsaw Confidential, and it's available now to purchase. You can purchase it right here on our show page or on our blog at moviegeeksunited.net/blog.
Explorer's been hit. Explorer, do you read? Explorer, over. Explorer. Astronaut is off structure. Dr. Stone is off structure. Dr. Stone can't pass. You must see Pat. You don't detach that arm to carry you too far. Listen to my voice. You need to focus. I'm losing visual of you. In 2 seconds, I won't be able to track you. Steve, this is Pat. I can't see you anymore.
largest opening in the history of Octobers is Gravity. Would it gross over $55 million? Or?
And remember, a lot of people are going, I mean, this is one movie that almost everybody is going to go see in 3D and at IMAX, you know. So, you know, I don't think
it'll drop off very much. I think it'll have a healthy life.
It could have a healthy life all of October, I think.
I think it'll still be playing, you know, in November and December even. So
what do we think of it?
Mesmerizing on a visual level.
I mean, like, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, seriously, like, well, first of all, it's the greatest 3D movie that's ever been made. Let's just go. We can at least say that. You know, it uses 3D perfectly. It's, completely immersive. I mean, the only way that it could make you feel like you were in space anymore would be if they had some anti-gravity machines in the theater somehow and everybody was floating, you know, the human personal level as well and performance. And I mean, if it has one weakness, it's maybe in some of the dialogue at the beginning, just a little bit too exposition-y or something or whatever, but very tiny. That would be my only slightly niggling comment that I would have to say.
So, Jerry, you like it?
I thought it was interesting. We went to go see the 3D on Thursday night, and I was really, it's Alfonso Cuarón's first film since Children of Men. I didn't realize it had been that long in between movies. But, I mean, it's very mesmerizing, and I got to give it to Sandra Bullock. She can carry a movie. I thought she did a great job in The Blind Side. I thought she was good in The Heat. But she can really carry a movie. There's something really, and I agree with you, Jamie. I think there are a lot of people saying it's better than 2001. But there are people saying that. And I don't agree with that, because I think 2001 is a very different movie. It is, as you said, about everything. Gravity is not about everything. Gravity is really about, almost you could say, like the Poseidon Adventure almost. It is about surviving this incident.
If Gravity's about anything, and it's I'm not saying it's not worthy, because it's not about the meaning of existence, but it's about
the survival
instinct. And if I had any problems with the movie, there were it was the bits in the script that didn't benefit that singular theme very much. Because, I mean, I had a back and forth with somebody online where I said the only part of the movie I really didn't like was the kind of the Hollywoodized George Clooney is the man on his last mission, you know, the whole song and dance that we've seen a million times. And then also the backstory that they give Sandra Bullock, where she has a dead child. I thought the movie would have been the same without that story. I mean, it's about the instinct that all living things have to survive.
Right. And I agree with that.
One thing about the movie, though, just to let me stick up for, I agree with those points in a large respect. But one thing I would say is that, you know, one thing that's positive about the film is that, you know, the studio originally wanted a man in Bullock's role, and Cuarón said, no, I'm going to have a woman in it because that's the way the story is. And to have her have that backstory, and also to have her emotional reactions, they don't negate her being a woman. It's not a man's role. It's just not. And so that's what I do like about her having the backstory with the kid, even though it is Hollywoodized and we've seen it before. That's not really the movie's fault.
I was on the edge of my seat during those sequences, especially when she's trying to get back in the ship and when she's getting to the Chinese station and everything. I was just like, I won't lie, I was on the edge of my seat. I don't mind the Hollywoodized story. You know, I think that actually gives it something.
Well, no, and
I don't think
I don't think the story itself is Hollywoodized. I'm just talking about those two little bitty aspects.
Right, right. Of elements, yeah.
The film itself feels like really bold and experimental. It could be an art film. Gravity, because it's about this lady that's lost in the midst of space for the entire running time on her own minimal dialogue.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And I love the speech that Clooney gives her. You know, it's tempting to want to stay out here, away from everything.
One thing I also have to say to speak to the experimental aspect of it too is that. It feels like it's almost, I know that it's, you know, the thing is, the first shot is like 15 minutes or whatever. But, you know, it's like one movie that, honestly, until its very end, I really can't remember very many cuts in it, many edits in it. So it's like, it almost feels like it's all one shot in some weird way. It gives you that experience. And also, it's a movie that takes place, I think, in real time. I mean, I think it's I don't think that it has any, you know, it's taking place in real time. The movie takes 90 minutes. By the way, that's another thing that's entirely kind of experimental these days, is to have a movie this big that's 90 minutes long.
My brother said the same thing about that, actually.
I mean, they didn't pad it out with an extra 30 minutes to make it feel more important. They just got right to it. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. It is kind of an art film in a lot of ways. And there are a lot of moments in it, like, well, I don't think this is giving anything away, but when she does get back into the ship, there's that great moment where she sort of, like, takes off her suit and everything, and she just floats in space like a fetus.
Like
an
embryo,
yeah.
Yeah,
and I thought, that's
which
great.
Brings,
that's even sort of...
That actually reminds me of Ripley.
Ripley
yeah.
is a totally first alien.
Well, what it's supposed to remind you of is the Star Child.
Yeah,
of course.
Exactly. Yeah, 2001 reference. Yeah, so exactly. But I love those little touches in it, too. And to tell you the truth, also, we should say this, but no one said anything about this, but... It's really a movie also that has a lot to do with movies like Apollo 13 and particularly The Right Stuff. And
oh, definitely.
But it's a movie about people who really do go in space, not just people, not just fantasy space, you know, where you're getting into a ship and going 1,000 miles and shooting lasers. It's a movie about people who really do work in space and the dangers of working in space. I think a lot of it's going to be like revelatory to people because they've never seen anything like this. People have never even taken into account the fact that, you know, in space, there's over 300,000 satellites up there. And what I mean by satellites is not just communication satellites, but like little pieces of space junk and stuff. And like a bolt... The size of
of course.
Speeding through space and hitting a spaceship could leave a hole the size of a refrigerator. So it's like people don't really know, or this movie kind of lets people in on the real dangers of it. And
I think if this got people 2001 when it came out. One of the byproducts was that a lot of kids wanted to become astronauts after watching that. My older brother and everyone. And I think, you know, yes, it's just, you know, the opening and everything, you know, it says all these harsh facts about space. But if this could get people interested in space exploration, then this movie's value and merit will last for decades. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is something very, it's beautiful. Just when you're watching it, just watching the Earth. Forget everything else. You're just watching the Earth in certain portions of the film, and you can't get over how beautiful it is, majestic it is. I mean, the view and everything. I mean,
yeah. And plus, I mean, well, I will say this. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of people who might actually get second thoughts about going into space because the movie does realistically portray the dangers and the difficulties of living in space. And
well, no, that's true. But there are people
really happening up there.
Yeah, But I think that there's a certain, I hope still, there's a certain segment of the population that is attracted to that. So, I mean,
well,
look,
you
it's a brilliant film. It's a brilliant film. I can't stress that enough.
I wanted to be a stripper after watching Magic Mike.
Especially since Magic Mike took place in Tampa, where you're at.
That's right.
It's right at your back door, dude. Go and do it.
There's lots of backdoor action there.
There's total rear entry boots.
The other survival thriller that opens this Friday, but it had a sneak preview last night, was Captain Phillips. I found out about it at 7 o'clock. It started at 7:30. I was like, oh, hell, let me hurry up and buy my ticket and race over there.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a really last-minute thing for me. Dean, I know you saw it. Jerry, did you see it last night?
Yes, I did, and I'll say this. I had to sit in the front row. It was that kind of last-minute thing. I didn't mind it, though. No, I didn't mind. It was good. I mean, but they put it, you know, they put it in the smallest theater, and I was just like, really, guys? I wanted to say you really couldn't take Insidious out of that one, and you couldn't put that in it, really? Okay, thanks, guys. Thanks for coming in for the home team here. I actually thought it showed all of Paul Greengrass's strengths as a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
I really did. That Green Zone didn't, you know, for that matter. I mean, the previous film, so.
Definitely not. I would agree. I mean, just again, you know, funny, kind of an interesting movie to see after seeing Gravity, but because they deal with a lot of the same things. But it had all of those. It had all that stuff that you know, his best film, you know, 1993 had. You know, great performances, a real sense of you're really right there in it, and. And sort of that military aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
trying to come in and solve problems, and great, at least two really great performances in it. You know, not just Tom Hanks, but the lead pirate, Arcot Abdi.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just keeps up with Hanks just every step of the way. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, just.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely a great supporting performance. He's definitely in there for the supporting actor Oscar this year. I mean, like, at least in the talk and the running. But extremely exciting. Very, I didn't really like the opening scenes with him going to the airport with Keener or whatever, but it improved greatly after that.
We are an unarmed freighter. We have a potential piracy situation.
Copy, Alabama. You should alert your crew. Get your fire hoses ready. Chances are it's just fishermen.
They're not here to fish.
Listen up. We have been boarded by armed pirates.
Stay hidden at all costs. Don't want any hostages.
We will follow the procedures, lock down, go dead in the water, and wait for help.
Stick together, and we'll be all right.
Where is the crew?
I don't know.
You think we're playing? You think we're playing?
No. You're going to shoot somebody. Shoot me.
Hey.
Look at me.
Sure.
Look at me. I'm the captain now.
1 minute, I kill all your friends. 1 minute.
Come with us! We're not getting everybody! Hey, don't get in there! Gotta get them off the ship! Now like this! I mean, I adored it. I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was fantastically intense. It's, you know, it's 2 hours and 15 minutes. It's a... and it just builds and builds and builds and builds to this, like... almost unbearable pitch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And which reminded me a lot of the climax of United 93, and you feel the same sense of underscore that kind of builds and builds and builds until you're, like, completely frayed. And then the movie has the great sense, because this entire performance of Tom Hanks, I thought, okay, this is one of those movie star performances where you just, you need someone that you feel completely comfortable with and empathetic with in the center of the movie. But I didn't see any, there weren't any kind of showboaty moments in it.
None at all. None.
So he was just like a stabilizing kind of force. But then the movie has a great sense to end the last scene of the movie. And everybody knows that knows the real life story knows that Captain Phillips survived. Is him like experiencing the trauma of that event? I think it's the best depiction of trauma that I've ever seen.
Of
on
shock.
That.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, without a doubt.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the movie has the sense to end it right there, and so you're left like, you're left with the release that the film builds up to for 2 hours and 15 minutes, and then it ends.
Yeah, it was superb. I mean, the screenplay was Billy Ray's screenplay was just right on the money there, you know, the structure of it and everything. It was just perfect, you know. The depiction of the pirates too was, I thought, eminently fair, and they were kind of a real motley crew but he's good at this. He's always been good at this, depicting like United 93 or even at least the earliest film I've seen by him is Bloody Sunday. He's really good at these type. He did wonders with the two Bourne movies he did. He took those to new heights. But he is very good at taking stories that you know and keeping you actively engaged and on the edge of your seat, really. We know how this ends, but still, it's still very exciting. It's very white knuckle, biting your fingernails kind of suspense.
It's a completely fascinating dynamic to see Hanks and the gentleman that plays the lead pirate share scenes together, because it's a complete study in contrast, and I think that's what the movie is too. I mean, they come from two terribly different cultures, they have different motivations, and they clash in the movie, but you also see how the lead pirate respects Captain Phillips, is actually quite considerate and kind to him for much of the movie. And he loves America. I mean, he's always dreamt of going to America. That's a fascinating character, the way they draw him.
That underscores the difficulty of living life in his home country of Somalia, where they kind of force guys like him to go and fight for a warlord or something that they might not really want to do. They're kind of forced into it. So it's like, those guys really don't have a lot of choices, and that's one of the reasons they're doing what they're doing in some ways, it's kind of a desperation move. So the movie is filled with that kind of desperation on both sides.
Two sides, different colors. One of them's got to win, one of them's got to lose.
I greet you for our annual North American Computer Chess Tournament. I present you with the best and the brightest.
We're just watching them get ready for the end of the world here. World War III.
Okay, so the computers play chess versus other computers. Wow.
And we have something new this year. We have a lady who is competing way in the back corner.
There she is.
If all computers can do is calculate, then what is artificial intelligence?
Computers are getting smaller, they're getting better, they're getting faster. It's a matter of time before we beat people with these things.
I'd be willing to bet that you and I are the only ones here who even understand that programming has a feminine side. That I would love to stay in your room if you have an extra bed.
It's a couples group. I don't know if you've ever done any encounter stuff or anything like that.
Look deep within me to find what is inside you.
Don't you think it's strange that we're all here at the same time?
Have you been with a lot of women, Peter?
Can you try something else? Can you try do your own move on your own?
Seems to be a little glitch here.
war is death, hell is pain, chess is victory.
You want to know the real future of computers?
Tell me.
Dating.
What, you mean computers are going to start dating each other?
Okay, so Dean, you've seen what you consider to be, at this point, your favorite film of the year.
Yeah, my favorite film of the year, I think so. It's called Computer Chess, and it's by Andrew Bujalski, who did Funny Ha Ha, Mutual Appreciation. I think he did Beeswax as well.
He did Beeswax, too. I met him. He's a nice guy.
He's a mumblecore, I guess, you know, famous for being one of the progenitors of that, but... I don't think that this is in that mumblecore frame because it doesn't feel improvised. It feels you know, fully fleshed out and written.
Right.
It's a interesting period piece set in 1980 at a computer chess convention where all these computer programmers come to pit their, you know, 1980s 80 era machines against each other by playing chess. And it's also fascinating too because it's shot in on 1980 era video camera technology. So old video, black and white video cam that's like a square, and it's imperfect, and it's very messy visually in some ways, but in a very like eerie kind of beautiful way. And it's really funny, kind of Altman-esque. It's got a big cast of characters in it, not hardly any names. There's, you know, Wiley Wiggins is in it, who was in Dazed and Confused and Waking Life, but other than that, you know, and there's Gerald Peary in it, who's a film writer, a film critic, and he plays the MC of the convention, who's kind of commanding the Sony cameras, kind of directing the Sony cameras in a very humorous way, and they're recording the event, and it's really a really, really kind of sideways, kind of sweet little movie about how these nerds that now kind of control the universe had difficulty making their way to that thing, and also having that goal, and also having trouble dealing with the real world, you know, with real people and so forth, and probably still do, because they live in sort of a cloistered world where they deal with technology most of the time. So, but it's also really funny. It's got a, you know, character in it that's, it's one of its main geeky characters is a kid that has a different view than his doctor, you know, who's kind of like his boss. And a different view on what AI can do and what it can mean and so forth. And he has kind of a dalliance, like a real, real gentle kind of dalliance with the first female that's involved in the computer game, you know. And she's there at the convention. She has a great scene in it. But there's lots of real interesting characters in it. It has a surrealistic element in it that comes up in the last, you know, half of it that maybe some people might not get or understand. And I would say that it's really just a sort of a playful kind of, it's almost like the movie itself is kind of like a computer program. And like a lot of the computer programs in the movie, it goes through a glitch and you see the glitch in the film. And, has an amazing final shot that I was like, what? I had to like rewind it like 10 times just to tell you, oh, that's so weird. But I just loved it. I thought it was extremely funny and beautiful and just strange and different. And it just hit all those marks that I really like, you know. I would put Gravity right now at my number 2 spot, but I think I still have to stick by Computer Chess now because it needs some support, and it just came on demand, so I really urge everybody to go and take a look at it, and I think you'll find some worth in it.
It's a really odd movie. I mean, it's an odd movie in that there's nothing like that out there right now.
Well, it is an Andrew Bujalski film, and those are always, you know, odd movies, so...
And these are about the guys, the guys that inherited the Earth, essentially, years after this movie takes place. I mean,
right, of course.
They ended up ruling the world.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, you know, that's one of its most fascinating aspects. But I do want to underline, too, that I think it's really funny. I mean, there were times in it I was really, really laughing very hard. So, I don't know. I just think it's a real winner, like on all fronts.
Have you, any of you guys seen Muscle Shoals yet?
Seen it yet? No. I'm gonna watch it. Definitely.
I'd love to see that. I'd love to see that, and I'd love to see 20 Feet from Stardom. But two great musical documentaries from this year that I haven't been able to see yet.
And also another really good musical documentary, just real quick, that's kind of fun. It's called Good Old Frida. It's about the secretary to the Beatles that was their secretary.
Yes.
That's a really interesting little movie, too. I mean, you know, definitely worth checking out. You know, not groundbreaking or earth-shattering or anything, but just definitely a different kind of perspective on that whole thing.
Yeah, like the doctors and nurses in Parkland. I'm kidding. We're not getting into that.
Please.
All right.
No, we're not getting into Parkland. Maybe a film we should talk about, and I think it may be the best of the year, is Nicole Hofstetter's Enough Said.
Oh, I can't wait to see it.
I really got to say, guys, this may be the best film of the year.
Really?
James Gandolfini one of his last performances is brilliant. But it's really Julia Louis-Dreyfus who gives the performance of the year. I mean, I know this will not get nominated for Best Actress, but I would give it to her over Kate Blanchett in a heartbeat.
Really?
Because this is the thing about Julia. She started out on SNL. She did Seinfeld. She's done all these TV shows and Veep. But, you know, the one thing no one ever wants to give her credit for is she's never playing the same role twice.
Mm-hmm.
But with Enough Said, it's just like, I've never seen this girl before. I've never seen this. This is amazing. Gandolfini is incredible because he's not playing Tony Soprano or anything we've ever seen before, but you have to look back and think, holy shit, who is this person? I've never seen this, and it's amazing. I've never seen this person before.
Hopefully this will segue into a better movie career for her. And, I get the feeling, having not seen the movie, but I definitely get the feeling that, I mean, what a tremendous blessing this script is for her. She probably got it, and she said, finally, something worthy of doing on. And,
exactly.
And I'm going to attack it with everything I have. So the movie has done really well in limited release.
And I have to say something. We talked about this, I guess, the last time we were on the air. You know, they do give away a major plot point in the trailer, but it's not a spoiler, really, because the way it is revealed, if you're really engrossed in the movie and watching it, you're still like, wow. The way it unfolds is you just got later. It's like a oh my god moment. You're like, wow. And I was worried about that because I was like, why would you reveal this in the trailer?
But the way it's revealed
is so incredible. It's just like, wow.
Mm. Well, it's nice to have a nice movie for adults. Yeah.
And Hall of Center never does anything bad. Still hasn't done a bad movie.
She really hasn't.
Very
That's
reliable.
Very true.
Mm-hmm. So, Dean, you saw another movie with Gandolfini in it.
Oh, yeah, I saw Violet and Daisy, which is a real unusual movie. It premiered in Toronto in, like, 2011, and it's just now getting, I mean, I looked it up on IMDb, and it finally got a theatrical release in the summer of this year, but it didn't really make much of a splash, even though it has a cast that includes James Gandolfini, and then Therese Ronan and Alexis Bledel and a few other people. Marianne Jean-Baptiste is in it, too. Mm-hmm. Really, really fascinating movie. It's two girly-girl kind of assassins played by Ronan and Bledel who are sent out to kill Gandolfini, and they just form a friendship with him and everything. And
that might not sound too interesting on that, on, you know, just the story level or whatever, but visually this movie is like, wow, this is really something else. I mean, it's really a very, very accomplished film on a art direction, cinematography, editing, music choices, stuff. Very, very accomplished. The director is Jeffrey Fletcher, who won an Oscar for Precious back in 2011, and this is his directorial debut. And really, he has much more of an eye than, say, Lee Daniels does for movies. I mean, like, just in comparison, like, Lee Daniels is just a rank amateur in comparison. So, and, you know, great Gandolfini performance, very low-key. It would have been a great movie for him to really go out on, and I guess, you know, in some ways he does, because I think it's just, if it's finding an audience at all, it's probably going to find it more on demand where it's finally at. But I just couldn't recommend it highly enough. I mean, maybe it's just me or whatever, but I was just like, wow, this is really quirky and unusual and funny and touching, and just a really, really good movie that nobody, absolutely nobody, is talking about. I just ran across it. I said, well, Gandolfini's in it, I'm going to watch it. Plus, I like Cerise Ronan, too, so it's like...
Yeah. It reminds me of Beautiful Creatures with Rachel Weisz. You remember that one?
Oh, I didn't see that one. That came out.
But it reminds me of that. I want to see it. I wanted to see this movie, Violent and Daisy, for years. I just didn't. It came out in a theater in Virginia, and it came and went, and I didn't get a chance to see it, so I'll watch it sometime on Netflix, hopefully before I die. But
God, you know, there's so many, like, when you think about it, Beautiful Creatures, Heavenly Creatures, Fierce Creatures, there's a lot of creature movies out there.
No, there are.
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, put Adjective Creatures. That should be the next movie, Adjective Creatures.
Yeah, it's true. Movie titles are, like, getting way too, like, confusing and, like, sort of like, what? Like, you know, I read an article about this recently, and they said they really do have a point where they were, like, saying, yeah, there's so many movie titles that say nothing, you know? They're, like, they don't even entice you to go see the movie. It's like, what? And so many B titles, The Conjuring, The Possession, the you know, like, I don't know.
Well, you know, that really bad title, what was it? All You Need Is Kill, which we were laughing about earlier in the year. That's been changed. I guess the studio woke up and thought, you know, that's a really stupid-ass title. So they've changed that to something like Edge of Tomorrow or something. No,
something really bland.
Or is Edge of Tomorrow the Disney, the undercover Disney movie?
Escape from Tomorrow. So, but like, yeah, that's going to be something else when we get to see that. Yeah, you're right. It's so easy to get confused with movie titles. Oh, is that the one? You know, like Beautiful Creatures, and then, you know, I have to say, I have to move on to talk about Rush. I saw Rush this weekend. Boy. Blah.
Ronnie Howard.
Totally.
But didn't you think
blah.
It was Ron, let me ask you this, Dean, did you think it was Ron Howard's best film in quite some time, though?
No, I didn't.
The fact
that he hasn't, it feels like he hasn't made a movie in, like, I mean, I know he made that Vince Vaughn, Kevin James thing.
He made the Vince Vaughn movie, and he made A Beautiful Mind, and the Angels and Demons, and the Da Vinci Code. But I would honestly have to say Rush is the first movie I've seen by him since Apollo 13 that I really liked.
I didn't really like it at all. I found it really dull, and I thought the main character was kind of dull, and hated the look of the movie, that sort of Euro-trashy look that it has. It looked like something like a softcore porn movie or something. I don't know what the deal was on that. And
wait, let me ask you, what's wrong with softcore porn?
Well, I just get, you know, after a while of seeing things with fuzzy gauze over the lens and everything. You start rubbing your eyes like, God,
right, you start rubbing your eyes. But I actually thought it was a good film. I actually thought it was a really good film because I didn't know much about this rivalry at all, and I thought it was actually pretty good. And I also thought these are both guys that are down on their luck. Down on their luck. And this rivalry is really, really suited for today because they're both, you know, really at this time as it's going on. Neither one of them is doing great, Nicky Lauer. And I thought it was fascinating. But it was the first movie by Ron Howard that I've seen. Since I would have to say Apollo 13, I thought it was really engaging.
Well, let's just say the bar has been lowered considerably for Ron Howard's achievements over the past decade. But I mean, so on that limited basis, I would be forced to say yes. But I mean, you know, it was edited reasonably well, and the sound was good, and Daniel Brühl was engaging. But I just sat there going, you know, even though it was a boring movie, Grand Prix was a much, you know, Jeff Frankenheimer's Grand Prix from the mid-60s was actually a much better racing movie because it kind of did the same thing. It showed like all these guys are kind of assholes off the track. But the track stuff was much better filmed and edited in that film than it was here.
You guys are also missing Frost Nixon. Right.
Oh yeah, Frost Nixon. Yeah, you got to give it. I mean.
Oh well, yeah. Well, no, Frost Nixon. But you know, that's a good movie too. But I actually thought this was a decent film, not a great film, but a decent film. And you know, comparing it to Grand Prix or Le Mans, I mean, those are definitely apt comparisons, or the Cannonball Run for that matter. But it's not a bad movie. It's something very fascinating about it. But it didn't. It hasn't lit up anyone's. If I can paraphrase Charlton Heston from True Lies, it's not lifting anyone's skirts.
it definitely isn't, and it's definitely not a hit. So, I mean,
What is up with Ron Howard? I think, like, you know, he tries to be very versatile, which is to his credit. He tries to do different movies every time. But I think what he's missing is a distinctive point of view, you know? There's like a blandness there, and you don't necessarily know how he views the world necessarily by watching his movies.
You definitely don't learn anything about the... You're absolutely right about that. I think that's the one element that's missing from his thing. It's like, I think he's just, you know, I think he just really loves making movies and so forth, but he's not really... He's not really telling us anything or revealing anything about himself as an artist, except to say that he's a journeyman filmmaker
filmmaker. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he's a reliable filmmaker. He gets the job done.
But then you see the movies that are undeniably great, like a Frost Nixon or an Apollo 13. But in a way, those are kind of foolproof. You know, because those scripts are so tight and the stories are so engrossing that you'd really have to go out of your way to screw them up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely
true. Yeah, no, that's true.
And I don't think that he's. I mean, Frost Nixon aside, which for me, for my money, wasn't that great. I mean, it had a couple of great performances in it and a great idea, but I didn't think it was insanely great. But. You know, for the most part, you know, his output has just not been, it really hasn't been that consistent. It's been consistent on a slickness level, but it hasn't really been that consistent. And I'm not a big Beautiful Mind fan at all. I mean, that's like one of the worst.
Well, I mean, it's got the Return of the Jedi ending. It's got the Return of the Jedi ending. So what do you expect from it?
I didn't remember the UI.
What does that mean? I think I know what you mean.
You know what I mean. You know what I mean. Jesus Christ, do I gotta spell
about,
that out?
You're talking about Beautiful Mind has a Return of the Jedi ending?
Yeah.
I don't know what you mean.
Well, then you guys need to really come over here and smoke a bowl with me.
he turns around, he sees his imaginary friend with other people
in
his
life.
Exactly. Okay.
That's all I could think of.
That's right.
I got you.
That's
got
a damn
right.
good analogy. You guys should fucking quote me on that. We can make some money from this show.
That's a good analogy. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Let's pause
yeah, thank you.
Reflect on Jerry's great analogy.
But the
Ron Howard movie that I still respond to like gangbusters is Parenthood. I mean, what a delightful, observant, funny, touching, tender movie.
I have to tell you, I completely agree with you on that. I think that might be his best movie.
Great movie.
I think also that might be the movie. I think that might be great because I think it's the movie that might reveal most. Something about his filmmaker, you know. I think that he felt a real affinity for that, and actually, as a parent, you know, a famous parent of now famous people, and also being part of a famous filmmaker film acting family, I think he really responded to that in ways that are telling in the quality of the film. So
and it's got that Empire Strikes Back ending.
Big time.
Okay, our final guest tonight, Larry Fessenden. He's been on our show before. He's a great guest, and he's got his fingers in a whole bunch of pies. He actually directs, he writes, he produces, he acts. You know, his last performance was in the movie You're Next, which is actually something that we talked about in this conversation. And as of this last conversation, he hadn't actually seen You're Next, and he's in it, which is interesting. His new project is the second season of his hit audio horror series, Tales from Beyond the Pale. This is a great concept, and I'm just so relieved it's been successful because this brings back old school storytelling that really ignites your imagination in a way that only radio and audio plays can. And he's got a great all-star cast involved in it, from Sean Young and Mark Margolis, Ron Perlman, to people like James LaGrosse and Vincent D'Onofrio is in it as well. There's a special that they have going on throughout the month of October where you get two free tales from Beyond the Pale each week. Starting now, you go to talesfrombeyondthepale.com for more details. Here's Larry to tell us all about it. So season two of Tales from Beyond the Pale, I guess to start out with, tell me the feedback you got from the first go-around and how that kind of inspired and shaped the second set of shows.
Well, I think Glenn and I felt that we were very well appreciated. The tales, which were originally recorded in a studio, was an array of stories by mostly filmmakers, and we had also a writer of novels, and there was just a real enthusiasm for the way the sound was so detailed and rich, and the whole season was very transporting, everything from the poster to the half-hour programs. And the host was kind of an entertainment as well, as he introduced and outroed the pieces. So we felt very encouraged. I mean, you never know with social media. It could be the same three guys up at night emailing you. No, we felt very loved, and it was nice that the box set, which was a physical release, was purchased quite liberally on Amazon and that sort of thing. So we feel we had a small core group of people that were excited about it, and we thought, let's do a second season. We were invited to do it live last October, and so that was really hard to refuse. It was a great way to step out of our comfort zone, step out of the studio, and try to see if we could capture the magic in a live setting. So that was the other reason we went forward with it. And once we had done them, we thought, well, gosh, we got to get them out. And so here we are.
Well, tell me about that live element. When you listen to these episodes compared to the first season, what does that live setting bring to it?
Well, I'll be honest, as one of the actors, what it brings is you only have one chance to get it right, and it can be a little spooky, and some of those little stammers and stutters are on tape there. But that kind of danger level is also exciting, and it makes it really feel immediate. And we occasionally allow the mics to pick up the audience, and it's fun to really feel like this was a one-time only performance, and now you get to savor it all over again. We did minimal sprucing up. A couple of the sound effects didn't get recorded properly when it was live, so we did go back in and tidy them up. But mostly you have a fairly immediate experience.
Mm-hmm. And it gives it a real, I mean, all live performance, it gives it a very special sense of energy, too, I think.
Oh, definitely. And I got to be honest, also, speaking as the host of the thing, you can tell that my performance as the guy introducing the episodes, it's considerably more broad than the intimacy that the studio brings. And I honestly, not necessarily for better, possibly for worse, but there you see the effect of being out in that room. You know, you're really, you know, you're reaching to the bleachers. Of course, it was a fairly small room. You know, so it changed everything. It's nice.
Yeah. But also, I mean, there's something magical about the old style radio plays, which you guys are emulating here. There's this kind of intangible quality where it forces the audience to kind of use their imagination in a way that films don't always achieve.
Well, I really agree. I think what has inspired Glenn and myself all along with this project is that we're stripping away the visuals. And, you know, with modern films, especially we work in genre, with horror, everything has become increasingly explicit, everything from the gore you're watching to even the creature design, because, of course, CGI, computer imagery, has allowed us to put every fantasy on screen. And if you strip that away, you remind the audience that it's their obligation to participate in the making of the images. And, of course, when you don't show it, when you only imply it with sound, the audience is building a picture, which is everyone's private nightmare, you know, becomes the story. And that's why we have so much fun with it. Plus, it's considerably cheaper. And not to let cameras.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, that's why I appreciate what you guys have done so much, because I think, just like you've said, movies today, I mean, they do all the work for an audience. An audience isn't used to bringing themselves to the movie. I mean, kind of meeting it halfway. And the best films invite you to do that. And so this format that you guys have embraced here, I think, is so valuable in that way.
Oh, that's great to hear. And I guess we're repeating ourselves in our enthusiasm for this. I completely agree. And I think audiences have to start working again, because, you know, we're in such a culture of dismissiveness, and everybody's like, you know, been there, done that. And I sort of like to say, well, what did you picture? You know, let's see what your monster looked like, or at least, you know, you won't be quite as harsh a critic if you've done some of the work. You know, maybe you need to think about the journey that the story is taking you on. And you know, so it's fun to remind people. Mind you, it's hardly like we're reinventing the wheel here. I think audio content is very popular now, with everybody having their own, you know, vast library in their pocket. So it's a good time for these to come out. People love podcasts and this sort of thing.
Well, obviously, yeah. I mean, I'm definitely in the podcast business, so I mean, I can attest to that. But I also think, you know, when you're dealing with an audio play, with a radio style play, it does feel so fresh, because, I mean, we're inundated with the latest technologies and all of that kind of stuff. We're used to being able to see anything realized on the screen. But what's old feels new again. It's like, go back to the basics, and it feels so fresh.
Well, I agree. And I feel that the entire mission at my little company called Glass Eye Picks is to sort of reinvigorate cliches and to, you know, let's tell a vampire story over again. Let's do a ghost story. Let's have a campfire and tell some yarns around the flames. You know, In other words, I'm sort of against the cynicism of that we've seen it all. I'd like to reawaken an appreciation for, as you say, just the most fundamental entertainment experiences. And in this case, we're speaking about audio dramas. We're speaking about, you know, the story told around the fire. I was very influenced in my youth by one of my friend's moms. Would indeed, we'd sit around the fire when we'd drive to his upstate place, and she told the story of Dracula. I hate to admit it, but that's how I encountered the story, not by physically reading the book. And it was so potent that I was terrified and made an embarrassment of myself by, like, you know, knocking on her door at night and saying, I'm scared. It was just so visceral. So I would love to bring some of that to the modern listener.
Yeah, and no matter what, I know that entertainment is about storytelling. And, I mean, this feels like a very pure form of storytelling. Tell me about your particular segment titled Caper.
Well, I confess that, you know, there's a lot of duties. Glenn and I both read all the other people's scripts, and we choose the stories we want, and then we try to shape them, and so there's a lot of editorial work. And I remember realizing that my day was coming, and it was a little bit scary to deal with that deadline. So I wrote it very intuitively, and I had the possibility to film in this giant mansion at one point, and so I had always percolated this story of some robbers going to this location and getting into a world of trouble because there's something wrong with the house. But with all my stories, it's about the psychology of the individuals. I always like to play with the horror tropes that we're familiar with, be it ghosts or vampires or werewolves or what have you, and then bring it back to the personal, as if the root of so much fear and horror stories is really our own self-betrayal. So these guys get inside this house, and they all have something that's haunting them. So that was the premise. And then, you know, I always like to comment on what do we consider scary. It actually takes place at Halloween, so they're looking out the window, and they're all commenting on all the costumes, everything from Frankenstein to Freddy Krueger to the Scream monster. And they're saying, what is scary? And, of course, in the end, they end up in this mansion, and they encounter real fears, which are really a mirror on their own guilt. So it's a fun little phantasmagorical piece.
Well, you said you wrote it intuitively. And just last week I was listening to an interview with a musician, and he said when he knows that he has a hit song when it just kind of channels through him, the ones that he has to really struggle with, he knows that the listening audience is probably going to hear that struggle, and it won't connect to them in the same way. Is screenwriting in any way similar to that?
I think it is. I mean, first of all, I make no pretense that this is a great piece. It's, I think, a serviceable, fun piece. I also wanted to have a radio play with as little dialogue as possible and see how far you can push the painting of the picture without visuals. But so that was another thing on my mind. As for the musician's comment, I mean, I love hearing that. I wish I had that kind of skill, even in my own, like, songwriting and stuff. It's always sort of laborious. But I do believe, I mean, that my favorite quote from Bob Dylan is that all those early songs, he said, I don't know how I wrote them. They just came to me. You know, I couldn't possibly write songs that iconic anymore. He was speaking later in his career. So I think, you know, there is this notion of divine inspiration. And when you let the material flow and you're actually just sort of trying to keep up with the image that's in your mind, that's the best screenwriting experience for sure. And of course you go back to refine, but when you're struggling with, you know, the cliche with the cards and you're putting them on the wall and then you're moving the order around, that always feels like trouble to me.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, yeah. You know, we've interviewed Vincent D'Onofrio a couple of times on this program, and the last time I talked to him was, I think, kind of last quarter of last year, I think I talked to him last, and he had just signed on to participate in this season of Tales from Beyond the Pale, so we talked about that for a little bit, and unbeknownst to me, I knew that he was an extremely popular actor and one of the great actors we have, but he has got such a large and vocal supportive fan base behind him, and a lot of them are on the Movie Geeks United bandwagon for us now too. So I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the experience of involving him in this project and what you gave him to do in this project.
Oh, well, thanks. That's so great. You know, it's a real treasure when you know, I encountered Vince because I was invited to help him look over a movie he had made, because it was a horror venture. And so we sort of hooked up through that. And I couldn't resist, you know, inviting him to do the previous season. And I had the pleasure to act with him in a show called Man on the Ledge. And that's a great tale of a guy out on the ledge, and I'm the detective talking him down. And we had a fun enough time that he came back to do this one live. And he really expressed a great deal of enthusiasm for the informality, just being among fellow artisans, and of course there's something pleasing, I think he felt, about the scale of it. You're really engaged for just 3 days. You do a rehearsal maybe, and then you get up there and you walk away having had a great evening and sort of shaped a character. Vince is really, he's very sweet. He actually, the two characters in the two different shows are very different. He's great in the one, The Ram King, where he plays a 16th century feudal lord, basically. And it's a really cool piece. It's actually by the same author who did the other radio play with Vince in it. And as you can see from that, they had a rapport as well. Mm-hmm. So it was fun because, I get intimidated when you're with celebrities. But what's nice is we try to create an atmosphere where we're all artisans again. And I think, you know, for some people who've been had their name in lights, it's kind of a relief to just get in there and just do the work and have some fun.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure that, you know, you as a performer as well, I mean, you deal a lot with the business and the BS of it, but when you build a structure where you're just allowed to kind of have freedom and play, I mean, that's got to be incredibly liberating for a performer.
I think so. And, you know, you also have the script in front of you, so you're not even worried about the practicality of the lines and so on. You're really just indulging in the imaginative world that you're mm-hmm. creating with your fellow players. And, you know, the funny thing about radio is that your relationship is not to the other actors. It's to the microphone and the world that the sound is creating. So while the usual advice from Chekhov on down is to, you know, look to your other actor, look in their eyes, react to them, and so on, in this case, you're actually listening to their voice, and that's the rapport that you develop. So there's all these peculiarities to working in radio that I think make it a fun venture. And, you know, look, we're all New Yorkers. It was fun to just get together on an October night and the leaves skipping across the road as you head down to your dreary business of making spooky nights for the little audiences.
So tell my audience how they can get a hold of season two.
Well, first of all, come visit talesfrombeyondthepale.com. Pale is spelled P-A-L-E. And there you'll see descriptions and nice posters. You know, we make a big effort to have these wonderful posters that announce each episode, and so you can, like a kid from the old days, you can sort of peruse the artwork and sink into the show. And all the episodes are for download there. If that's too much effort, you can go to iTunes and use the card you have already registered and it's on Amazon and Audible, so they're all over. And, you know, if you enjoy any one of them, I can tell you that both seasons are just incredibly varied and wonderful. There's everything from aliens to ghosts to serial killers, but all very subtle and unexpected. Well, not all of them. Some of them are pretty ham-fisted. But there's some really deviant things on there. But I also like to say that they're quite literary. I mean, after all, we've spoken about sound effects and atmosphere, but there's also a celebration of the spoken word, because that's what's at play here, you know.
Yeah. You know, you're involved in so much. So, and I know that you must love every aspect of filmmaking, because you're embedded in all of it. I mean, you have your film that you directed, Beneath, that just came out. You're part of a Living Dead documentary. You're in the film You're Next. I have to tell you, by the way, I finally saw You're Next this past weekend, and it scared the bejesus out of my girlfriend. So thank you for that.
Honey, I'll take care of you.
That's got to be a special treat. I mean, that movie has. I've heard from my friends nothing but praise about it. I loved it. It's a great, scary, fun picture. That's got to be a great treat to have that out there as well.
Oh, it is indeed. But listen, man, I'm not going to be like Johnny Depp and say I don't see my movies. But the fact is, I have not been able to get to it. And this weekend, I was alone in the city, and I was determined, but too many things came up. So I still haven't seen it.
you're too busy to even see the movie that you're in.
It's kind of true. I can't say I'm doing anything worthwhile, but I am doing it. So I'm very busy.
Well, I got to tell you, I appreciate everything that you do, and you're always a great conversation. I really appreciate your time, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jamie. Very fun to chat.
Okay, that was Larry Fessenden. It's Tales from Beyond the Pale, a great audio horror series that you can find online at talesfrombeyondthepale.com. Thank you so much, Larry, for giving us your time.
What did we all think of the actual finale of Breaking Bad?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I guess we should, you know, wrap things up on that front. You know, what are you going to say? I mean, there were a lot of loose ends to tie up. It already sounds like I'm making excuses for it. Some people were disappointed in it. But ending to a show like this is kind of inevitably going to be, on some level, kind of disappointing, because, you know, you have so much expectation built up. It's kind of unfair, you know. So it's, but I thought it worked just fine, and it didn't have quite the same energy level as some of the other episodes, but that's because Walter White's energy level is depleted. So
because there's a finality to it, and there has to be a finality to it, and the stuff that's really adrenaline pumping about a lot of Breaking Bad, that series, is how's he going to get out of this? But you know, for there to be finality to something, ultimately he's not going to get out of it. I mean,
no, he's not.
This is the end.
Mm. Yeah, and you know it when the show is beginning. This is the end. Not only just the end of the show, but the end of the character. It's just got to be.
Yeah.
So there's no more speculation about what's going to happen or anything. It just happens, and I think a lot of people who might be disappointed in it, they might be misreading their own emotions and actually, you know, that's the emotion that they're feeling, is that the lack of speculation and excitement about what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. That's just not there in that episode. So, I mean, and there's no reason it should be. So, but you know what was really the most exciting thing about the episode was its final 5 minutes. With that Bad Singer song coming up on the screen, up on the soundtrack, and Walter in the lab, you know, bleeding to death and lovingly petting all of the equipment and everything. Mm-hmm. And you're right, that was the big surprise in it. That was like, oh, wow, yes, this was his real true love. I mean, he loved his family and all that kind of stuff. But what he really did it for was
I think he was using the family thing. Of course, it's in his last scene with Skyler. You know, it's talked about. He was using that family thing, but he didn't just do it for him and the fact that he loved it and had fun doing it and all that kind of stuff. But he really loved chemistry and working there and working his magic in the lab, and very, very prideful about that thing. And that's the reason he did it. And that's what we get in
that
last 5 minutes.
Well, I thought that was beautifully explained in that scene with Skyler, that reveal when he's there. Is just classic, and that's going to be copied for years to come. It was very interesting because he really admits, I was great at this. And that's just such an awesome scene. I really have to, you know, jump on the bandwagon here. We're not going to get anything this good for a long time. Who knew?
Here's a list that was released, the favorite movies of Quentin Tarantino so far this year.
Yeah, I saw this.
Oh, God, okay. How many are there, first of all? It's only 10, right?
10, yeah.
All right, let's dissect this fucker.
Let's dissect this fucker. Is that what you said in Syed's class in elementary school before you did the frog? Let's dissect this.
No, I got tripped on the way to the bathroom, but okay.
His number 10 is This Is the End. That would be on my top 10 at this point of the year.
Oh, that would, okay.
I can see that disappearing when I see more fall movies, but, you know. His number 9 is The Lone Ranger.
I have to intervene here.
Well, first of all, I can tell you why he likes The Lone Ranger, because he's got a hard-on for movies that show American Indians in the driver's seat. So, I mean, that's why he doesn't like, you know, John Ford, because they're killing Indians left and right and stuff.
Well, you know, Dean, come on. Let me, you know, as much as I love Quentin Jerome Tarantino, let's BS. I mean, he just loves that because of the letter that John Wayne wrote to Clint Eastwood. No, that's The Lone Ranger. Let's see what else is on this list. The Lone Ranger. That's like talk about a misvaluing judgment. Oh my God. Okay.
And plus, don't you think? I mean, I love Tarantino's movies, but loving Tarantino's movies and fully embracing the man are two different things.
Uh-huh.
Don't you think that a lot of times he's just trying to be provocative?
He loves showgirls. Remember that year he loved showgirls. So,
well, I don't blame him for loving showgirls. I love showgirls too. The moment I saw it, I thought, oh, that was genius. But I mean, like, that's just me though. I wouldn't put it in the
Have access to a porn tape or something? All right, Dean,
it was hilarious movie. It was like something I'd never seen before. And I fully believe that showgirls is absolutely meant to be hilarious.
So it's Joseph Goebbels' bar mitzvah movies. All right, go to the next one.
Number 8, Kick-Ass 2.
I've lost total respect for this man. That movie sucked on so many levels. It's not even funny.
Number 7 is Gravity.
Okay.
Thank God.
Finally, a good movie in here. Number 6 is Francis Ha.
Yay. Okay, yeah. Thank God. All right.
Number 5 is Drinking Buddies.
Oh, why would you put that?
That completely surprises me. That actually does really surprise me, because that's a movie that's not written. So I would think that the writer in Tarantino would completely resist that movie.
I think so too, but would someone send me a copy of it to watch? But okay.
Number 7 is The Conjuring. Number 4 is The Conjuring.
That's an awesome choice.
Number 3 is Blue Jasmine.
Okay.
So it's getting better, you see. Number 2 is Before Midnight.
Okay.
And number 1, who has a guess as to what number 1 is?
I've seen the list, but I can't remember what number one is.
I haven't seen the list, but I want to say Mud or The Place Behind the Pines, and I know it's either one of those.
Okay. His number one is Afternoon Delight.
I've seen that. Wow. Because I haven't even heard of it. Like, what is
that movie? I've watched it.
Jerry talked about it the other week.
Yeah, that's his favorite movie of the year so far?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it, but I
don't... What is that movie, Jerry? What is it?
It's all right. Katherine Hahn from Saturday Night Live. She's in it with her. Oh God, what is it? The guy's name's Josh Raynor, who is the actor. He was also in the movie, which I really loved a lot more, Liberal Arts. But their marriage is stale, and she lived in her house. Juno Temple, who is a stripper. This takes place in Echo Park, I think. I want to say Echo Park, Los Angeles. That's the movie. And I remember talking about this. Yeah. It's a good movie, but you're not going to put the place beyond the pines or mud? Oh, my God. Oh, God. This is like Showgirls all over again.
Maybe he hasn't seen Computer Chess, but... It would seem like if he did some of those movies, he would certainly get Computer Chess.
I would think if Afternoon Delight is his favorite movie of the year.
Yes, it is. That's very weird.
I know. He's still smarting from going out with Lillian Spider Baby, who. How is it a plagiarist? So I think he's still smarting from that.
And that is a tough position. If you're with a woman and she becomes like a public spectacle in any way, and do you behave like you're pussy whipped and come to her defense, or especially when there have always been cries accusing him of the same.
It's huge. But, okay, so Afternoon Delight is his favorite movie of the year. We can only go up from this point, like Counselor or American Hustle or Old Boy even.
Hey, do you know that Danny Lloyd did an interview? The kid from The Shining
did
an interview. For the first time, really. I mean, he did a sit-down interview with The Sun, a UK publication.
Hmm.
I haven't read it because you got to pay for a subscription to The Sun in order to get the article or the video. He says he has fond memories. He didn't know he was in a scary movie. The film was shot out of order, and he was shielded from any bloody imagery. It was all fun and games and an opportunity to ride a tricycle around indoors. He was shown a severely cut-down version of the film when he was young, but didn't see the complete film until he was 16 when some friends rented it from a video store.
Wow.
Danny Lloyd, as I very well know, because I've tried to get him for many years. I got his email. I had an interview request hand-delivered to him. I tried everything I could to get this man on the show. He is now 40 years old and teaching biology in Kentucky. He said his three children just don't think much of The Shining. They just mostly make fun of his haircut.
Which I agree, there are some funny shots in that movie of his, the various hair is kind of very strange. But
yeah.
Particularly the shot where he's sitting there and he's shaking and silently reacting to something that Jack Nicholson is doing, and he's kind of drooling, and his hair looks very weird.
Yeah.
I was like, is that the same kid? Very bizarre. But
here's some news that'll make you happy, Jerry. I'll talk about two movies that they recently had screenings of. The first is Fury Road, which is the fourth Mad Max movie. Tom Hardy takes over the role of Mad Max, and it's from George Miller. I mean, people think, oh, they're redoing Mad Max. What a bad idea. But then you got to take into account, no, the original guy is remaking it. Or not remaking it, but
is it
going
back. Can I ask you both a question? Do you consider this a remake or a continuation?
No,
it sounds like
that's why I just corrected myself. Yeah. But they screen Fury Road, and they say it's incredible. They say it's incredibly action-packed and thrilling. They say it's great. So that's good news.
Wow. It is good news, yeah. I mean,
Here's how good
the news
is. Well,
I can't wait to see it.
They went back for reshoots because he wanted to shoot something that the studio thought was too expensive. So he just wrote it
out. Yeah, I read that last week. Yeah.
Well,
let me explain it to
the listeners. So he wrote around it. But then they saw the rough cut of the movie, and they said, this is so good. Why don't you go back and shoot that scene that you wanted to make it even better? So that's encouraging.
Yeah, yeah, that is. That they actually reversed themselves and said, oh, shit, maybe we're throwing caution to the wind and cash to it, too. So go ahead and go and do what you originally wanted to do.
Right.
And they should put their trust in him, because let's face it, that's another very reliable director. I mean, like, how many things has he done that you just like, ugh, you know, like, not really that many, you know?
Yeah.
And he's a groundbreaker in many ways. And I'm not just talking about Mad Max, but I'm talking about Babe as well, you know?
Who would have thought that the guy that made Mad Max made Babe? I mean, those are two.
No, I never, it never dawned on me until I saw Babe. That would be... Yeah, that is weird. You know,
I rewatched one of his movies. I rewatched one of his movies a couple of months ago, which was Witches of Eastwick. And you know, like such an, you know, that's a problematic movie. But there are elements of it that are so completely irresistible. Mostly because it's Nicholson, like, letting loose, playing the devil, and it's there's a lot of delectable stuff in that movie.
I really love also Veronica Cartwright, who I feel also let loose in her own, like.
Oh,
well,
yeah,
own,
we did a whole show about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, like, I dig that movie too. I really like the Lorenzo's Oil too. Like, that's another one that I like. You know, that's very different. You know, but about the only movie that his that. And I don't even remember if he directed this, but about the only one that I don't like is maybe Thunderdome, you know? That's the only movie of his.
Well, he had a co-director for that one, I think, George Ogilvy. And I don't hate that movie, but it's just that it's so, it suffers from, at the same time, if you'll bear with me, Doctor Who, when Peter Davison was a doctor in the mid-80s, they got more money. So it's sort of, and it's the same thing happened with Mad Max. The beauty of the first two Mad Max movies is they're shot on shoestring budgets. And then you get to the third one, and they have a lot. But I think that the Beyond Thunderdome has some really, as a whole, it's not great, but it has some incredible sequences in it.
It does. Yeah. I mean, in the first 40 minutes or first half of it, I like the Thunderdome parts. I think they still work. But it's afterwards when he gets out and is amongst all those kids. I haven't seen it in years, but, you know, amongst all those kids in the wilderness or whatever.
reminds me of those damn kids in Once Upon a Time in America. Those damn kids.
You just don't like children. Let's be honest. I mean,
Is there any penny whistle in the score to Beyond Thunderdome? Dude, is that aggravates you?
Well, no, actually, Beyond Thunderdome, you have Maurice Gerard as the music for it, so that's there.
I was just making fun of Dean's opinion.
I know.
Also, the other movie that they screened last week was American Hustle, and all the reports that have come in from that say that this is David O. Russell's masterpiece. You know,
really,
you also have to take into account that these are normal people. These are people from off the street that they pull in and say, "Hey, you want to go to a screening, see a movie months early?" And so those movies are usually colored by an over enthusiasm. But if the movie didn't wow you on some level, then they would come out and they would go the opposite way with it and completely and totally trash it. But I'm sure the movie's very good. Yeah.
It's a story that needs to be told, and I think we've been waiting around for storytelling the Abscam thing for a long time. So I can't wait to see it either. I mean, talk about another guy that's completely
seemingly infallible. Never done anything bad. You know, this is not going to be bad. I mean, there's no way. Not with that cast. Not with all the powers that are behind it in terms of the craft and the actors and the writers and stuff like that. So and the subject matter. It's just no way that's going to be a disappointment.
And they say the music in it, the songs that he selects, are like a greatest hits compilation from the 70s. They say it's like one of the best score soundtracks that they've heard.
Yeah, I get that just from the trailer. So I mean,
yeah.
I love the use. I watched that trailer like four times yesterday. You know, because it's in front of every movie. And I said, you know what? I never get sick and tired of watching this trailer. You know, but I was sitting there like before Gravity, just to change the subject a little bit. But I was sitting there before Gravity, and they had the phalanx of trailers, you know, like 10 trailers before the movie starts.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, first they showed the Thor trailer. Then they showed the Lord of the Rings trailer. Then they showed that 47 Ronin or whatever it is, the thing with Keanu Reeves. And I was like, I cannot believe how much each one of these movies looks exactly the same. They have exactly the same kinds of, like, sweeping landscapes with a city on a hill and absolutely the same kind of fighting things in each one. There's lots of fighting, and I'm like, I don't see how
Wait.
I don't see how anybody who's a fan of this genre does not go to each one of these movies and go, Jesus Christ, maybe I need to give these a break for a little while.
Where was all that shit in the original 47 Ronin? Part 1 or Part 2? Where were the hell was all that stuff?
That's true. A lot of people have never seen that, so the I just couldn't believe, like, and then finally, you know, Secret Life of Walter Mitty, that preview pops up, and it's like, finally, a movie that actually, at least in some way, takes place in the real world. Like, finally, something that looks different, that doesn't
have
that burnish.
Well, that's a movie that takes place entirely in a fantasy world.
Well, I know, but I mean, at least it's, I know that it's a fantasy thing, but at least it does start off with a guy in an office,
yeah.
And, like, you know, so I mean, like,
it feels like this is maybe his Joe versus the Volcano and Ben Stiller. This has been a passion project of his for a long time.
It has,
and he stars in it and directs it, and it just premiered at the New York Film Festival to very lukewarm reviews. They say it's not very good.
Yeah, I have to say, even though I'm not a huge Ben Stiller fan, it looks fascinating, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to go see it, but
it looks like an ideal holiday movie. I mean, it looks like it's made for,
Yeah, I mean, I feel kind of like that about that movie that I do kind of like about Her, you know, the Spike Jonze movie coming out. Like, it looks kind of quirky and looks like it has elements in it that I'm gonna dig.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'll dig the whole movie, but it looks like there's enough to, like, bring me to it. And, you know, so, but I think people are kind of like overestimating, you know, Walter Mitty's, you know, year-end aspects and the awards and stuff like that. Some people predicting Best Picture just on that trailer, that one trailer that didn't have any dialogue in it. It was just sound, just a song and images and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you have a great song and a lot of, like, crazy images like that movie does, it would be very easy to sell a movie and make it look like, oh, this is going to be the greatest movie ever. But but then you're not really getting into the actual details of it either. So, you know, when you see the one that has the dialogue.
All right. This is a list from Dean Treadway.
Awesome.
RupertPupkinSpeaks.blogspot.com. It's a list of 13 films that he recommends in the underrated horror category.
Okay, well,
I think these are all good lists, by the way. So it's ten movies, but yeah.
Oh, I thought it was 13.
No, I think it's 10.
Okay, number one, Showgirls. No, you're kidding. Dying Breed. This is a 2008 film from director Jody Dwyer.
Yeah. He's a former editor who worked under Kubrick, and it's just this Australian movie kind of about this woman that goes to investigate where her sister died on vacation, and she discovers, you know, a cannibalistic crew of people out there, and you could kind of guess the rest. But incredibly horrifying, I thought. You know?
Something about Australian horror. You know, I guess it's the landscape there that makes Australian horror like a genre all of its own.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
And this actually highlights a kind of different kind of landscape because it goes to Tasmania, so it's kind of more jungly, kind of, and a little less deserty. So it's like, but yes, you're right. It is that. You know.
That reminds me. I don't know when you're saying jungly and deserty. It reminds me of that scene that always cracks me up in The Fisher King. I'm looking for a Catherine Hepburn-y, Cary Grant-y kind of thing, and then Jeff Bridges hands her a video of porn video. And she's like, ordinary peepholes? And he's like, yeah, it's a big titty spread cheeky kind of thing. I love that scene.
Spread cheeky.
Tessus from Alejandro Amenábar.
Yeah. It's actually Thesis, you know. I mean, it was kind of released here with the H put in there, but yeah. It's kind of an alternative kind of to the whole you remember that Nicolas Cage movie, that 8mm, where he investigates the making of a snuff film. She's a woman that's looking, doing a thesis for her college work on violence in the media, and she gets a report that there's a snuff film kind of buried away in the archives of her university, and she goes to investigate it, and it leads her to lots of bad things happening, and it's really good. It won six the equivalent of the Spanish Oscars, the Goyas. It won six of those, and very, very good lead performance and excellent support from one actor in particular whose name escapes me at the moment. But it's kind of funny, but it's also like extremely horrifying.
The Nanny, which is a 1965 film. It's a Hammer horror film, right?
Yeah, with Betty Davis is the nanny, you know, like this is like in 65, so it's like she's just coming off of Baby Jane. I think it's one of her few British movies that she did. She did a few British movies, like The Anniversary and stuff like that, which was another Hammer horror movie. But this was in black and white. She plays this nanny at a rich, you know, mansion. And a kid comes back from... He was sent away to a mental institution for a little while after he was blamed for the death of his 5-year-old sister, a drowning death in a bathtub. But he contends that it was the nanny that did it. And you know, we kind of suspect that he's telling the truth, but no one will believe him. And everybody in the household, like the father, is checked out with business, and the mother is going through a nervous breakdown, and the aunt's sick with a heart disease, and the only person that will believe him is his next door neighbor, who's a 13-year-old teeny bopper, and it's really, really good, very effective, beautifully shot and scored, and you know, it deserves to be mentioned in the same breath as Baby Jane in terms of Betty Davis's career.
By the way, today is the anniversary of Betty Davis's death. She died in 1989, I believe. She was 81 years old. And a couple of weeks ago, I was looking at YouTube clips of interviews with her in later years with Carson and with a couple of other people. Man, she was a pistol. What an interesting woman, like, you know, alive till the very end in every sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. The Wild Man of the Navidad, 2008.
Yeah.
Jesus. When you talk about, like, under-the-radar movies, you really go all the way.
Well, you know, actually, both of those 2008 movies, Navidad and also Dying Breed, were two movies that I actually saw while going to the Tribeca Film Festival that year. So, I, you know, they, but, yeah,
Yeah, Wild Man of the Now God is really interesting, especially if you're a Texas Chainsaw fan, because the co-writer is Ken Hinkle, and he's actually a producer of it, too. And then there's Charles B. Pierce, who did, you know, those, like, the Town That Dreaded Sundown and Legend of Boggy Creek. He's a consultant on it. But when you watch it, you're like, wow, it's hard to believe that this movie wasn't made in the 70s. It looks, it's kind of like, in some ways, it's kind of like Grindhouse. It really convinces you. It feels like a movie that was made back then and buried in some vault and they pulled it up. And it's got
There's a couple of movies I felt the same way about. There's even something like House of the Devil felt like it was made in the 80s, which is much different from let's dress it with as much 80s like memorabilia as we can find. It actually felt like it was made during that time. I mean, that's a special, it's a special kind of intangible quality a movie can have.
It just shows that those film directors are like looking at the details, the very small details, like the way things are edited and the way the credits look and the way the music looks and the way the things are framed and cast and everything. The Wild Man and Now the Dog's really good. It's just about a monster in the woods and people trying to find the monster and everything. And it's done in Texas, so it has, you know, has that sort of weird Texas feel to it.
Next up is Deranged, not the Jennifer Aniston film, but the movie from 1974.
that's a really good one. It's Alan Ormsby.
Oh, Derailed. That was the Aniston Derailed. Okay.
Right. And it's not Besieged, and it's not, you know, all those Betrayed or anything like that. Deranged is basically the retelling of the Ed Gein story, you know, the same thing that, you know, inspired Chainsaw and Psycho, but it actually cleaves much closer to the actual story, you know, where it was a farmer in Wisconsin and his mother dies and gets buried, he exhumes her, and then he starts killing people, killing women and using their skin to reconstruct his mother. His skin has fallen away because it's decomposed off. And you can tell it's like, it's a very, very happy story. Very, very, very difficult movie to watch in a lot of ways because it's just so grimy and horrible that, honestly, it's one of the few movies that I saw as a drive-in kid, like back in the 70s, that I kind of wish I hadn't seen because it was a little too traumatic for me. But definitely something, great lead performance, Robert Blossom, who really didn't get a lot of lead performances. He's really more of a character actor in things like Home Alone and Close Encounters and Handle the Care and Resurrection, you know. But he's really good, and he's totally all in on it. And if this kind of thing's your bag, then you're going to dig it.
Okay. Next up, Jigoku?
Jigoku from Japan from 1960. I can't remember the filmmaker's name, but it's the only one that I picked that's actually got the Criterion released. Nakagawa, right, exactly. And it's basically a tour through hell. It's like, the first part of it is one man's life on Earth and the deaths that he accidentally or maybe not so accidentally causes, and then he dies and is sent to hell, and that's the meat of the movie, where it's like, you know, you're just going through hell and there's different tableaus that are showing the punishments that are meted out to people in hell, and it's just ridiculously colorful and horrible and gory and weird, you know.
Yeah, Japanese very horror is something else. I mean, talk about Australian horror, but Japanese horror probably has made the most indelible mark on American horror as any genre of horror in the past few years. We end up remaking everything that the Japanese make.
Well, I'm waiting for the remake of Jigoku. The American remake of Jigoku should be really good. They should really do that. They should do a movie called Hell and just do it like that.
I think that was that's pretty much every Adam Sandler movie is The next one we don't have to discuss because we discussed it at length one of the last shows, and it's Rob Zombie's Lords of Salem, one of the most amazingly photographed movies, in Dean's opinion, of this year. The next movie actually is probably one that a lot of people know the name of, know by name, but probably haven't actually seen, which is Let's Scare Jessica to Death. I remember this being like a staple in creature feature kind of television when I was the youth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, has it been a long time since you guys have seen it? Did you ever watch it? I mean, yeah, it's great. It's John Hancock, who was more famous for doing things like Bang the Drum Slowly or, Buster and Billy and with J. Michael Vincent and California Dreamin'. This is one of his few forays into horror, maybe his only one that I know of. And it's Zora Lampert. She's just gotten out of a mental institution. She goes to live in this rural house that might be haunted, it's really about her kind of grappling with whether she's crazy or whether things are really happening here. The lead performance in it is just unforgettable, and it's really got that great sort of 70s look to it too that you just love. I would highly recommend that one.
I Saw What You Did, William Castle movie from 1965.
Yeah, with his latter-day scream queen. I guess since we had Bette Davis, I had to give a shout-out to Joan Crawford, too. So she's in a kind of supporting role, but it's really kind of a funny movie. It's got a simple premise, basically. It's two teenage girls having a sleepover at the girl's house. It's in black and white, shot by Joseph B. Rock, in very, very, like, horror kind of lighting. But it kind of starts out like it's like a sitcom or something, so it's like watching a sitcom that's lit like a horror movie. But anyway, two teenage girls get together, sleep over, and then they decide to spend some of their time making prank phone calls. And it's the trouble that they get into with Joan Crawford is involved, and they get involved in the mess that she's dredging up in her life. And Joan Crawford is trying to play, you know, that sort of, I guess if you saw Mommy Dearest, you remember those scenes where the latter-day Joan Crawford is like trying to act like she's still 30 years old and beautiful and everything, but she's actually hideous. And like, it's actually that movie. So it's like she's playing these scenes, and you're like, oh, these romantic scenes are horrible, and because she thinks that she can still do it, and it's just, it's terrible. But anyway, the movie is really, really, like, I think intentionally funny. Some people might say that it's unintentionally bad. I think it's intentionally funny. I think William Castle, who's famous, you know, for being a, you know, kind of a quirky horror director, I think he knows exactly what he's doing. And it's a lot of fun. If you get together and watch it with a couple of people and have, you know, bring out the liquor, I think you're going to dig it.
Finally, the last choice is At Midnight, I'll Take Your Soul from 1964.
that's an unusual film. It's from Brazil. It's Jose Mojica Marins, who was famous for playing Coffin Joe. This was the first Coffin Joe movie. And to give you an idea of how famous this character was, in Brazil at least, later on, when Jose Mojica Marins made other movies where he wasn't playing Coffin Joe, he was billed as Coffin Joe. So, in other words, it'd be like having Christopher Reeve in Remains of the Day, but he's not billed as Christopher Reeve, he's billed as Superman.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's the movie has Superman in it. and the Optimus. So basically Coffin Joe is a character that he did. He's just basically the devil, and he's here on Earth, and he wants a woman to bear his child. And so he kidnaps all these women and puts them through all of these terrible tortures to see which one has the hardiest composition that can actually win, you know, the privilege to carry his spawn in their belly. So, lots of horrible stuff happening to women, but it's really unforgettable. And the character of Coffin Joe is kind of unforgettable too, because he's kind of driven by, you know, this huge ego. He thinks he's the greatest thing on earth or in the netherworld, and that alone, you know, he kind of looks like Stanley Kubrick gone wrong. Like, you know, he's got big long fingernails, and he's got the beard, and he kind of is a little chubby, and you know, has a top hat on. And anyway, it's really something else. Like I said, there's like 14 Coffin Joe movies out there, and the
wow.
Next one too, Tonight I Will Possess Your Corpse, is also pretty good too. But yeah, very, very
well, those are great. Great titles, man. They really knew how to name them back then, didn't they? Okay.
Yeah, how are you going to forget that title? Tonight
yeah,
I Will
yeah.
Possess Your Corpse. Now that's
yeah.
a title.
Yeah. And let's close the show now with a piece of film score from another new release this weekend that opened with a whimper, and that's Runner, Runner. I think everyone ran away from it. But
yeah. It seems that way, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that doesn't portend good things for Batfleck, but...
Batfleck. You know, it looked completely bland, just for the
uh-huh.
trailer. It looked like another one of those Harrison Ford-type movies that should have come out 15 years ago. Like, why are they
uh-huh,
making it today?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's so true. It's time to move on, guys. Let's start making some different kind of movies now.
Yeah, when you got more sophisticated storytelling on television... You know, movies need to fucking catch up. They really do.
They really do. That's absolutely true.
Okay, guys, so next week we'll be back with Danielle Harris and a great conversation. Let me tell you, this is a really nice conversation with film critic, author, and historian David Thompson, where we talk about his new book, Moments That Made the Movies, and it's a really interesting discussion about movie moments and what they
mm-hmm.
mean and how we separate them from the actual movie and how our memories are essentially moments. It's an interesting one. You guys are going to want to tune into that one.
I'm going to want to buy
guys.
That book. That sounds great.
Yeah, definitely.
It's, gorgeous.
I mean, definitely
it's a gorgeous book. Yeah, it really is. Okay, guys, I'm looking forward to it. I'll talk to you next week.
All right.
Good night, everyone.
See you guys.